Welcome to the Yeshiva Shalmaila. This is David Lichtenstein. We have a wonderful program from around the world. We're going to be having from Toronto, Rav Mordechai Kaner. He wrote the book on Ribbis, and he's going to have some really fabulous examples for us. He's going to tell us about a case where 99%, if you learned in Eretz Yisrael, you have a sister, a daughter in Eretz Yisrael, 99% chance you arrive on Ribbis without knowing it. Joining us from Brooklyn, Rabbi Baruch Miller, a Rav in Brooklyn. He's Drosh Koyl and the great Yeshivas Devardik. He's also going to be discussing, he's a Magid Shir on Ribbis. And then we have a surprise guest, Rav Ari Zivotofsky, who's going to be speaking about the kashrus of turkeys. He spent decades researching the kashrus of birds and other chayas. And he's like one of the experts in the world. He's going to be explaining to us why more of us don't do like Rabbi Yankiv, who didn't eat the turkey, because the Shulchan Aruch says you need a Messiah to eat any bird, because we don't know today, but Brewer's what the Simonim are, and Mechaber and Ramon Pebez, and why isn't a turkey treif? So really, this is a wonderful program, and I have to tell you, where else in the world can you get, I'm patting myself on the back, where you can learn B'iyun from hearing from so many Rabbanim on diverse, multi-continents on such fascinating topics. A day in Yeshiva. Rabbeisai, what are your thoughts? 732-806-8700, press number 2. That's for what the B'nai HaYeshiva have to say. Or info@headlinesbook.com. We will post both messages, voicemails, as well as written, unless you request otherwise. But we're interested in what the Olam has to say. I'd like to discuss a few of the voicemails we got. Last week I spoke, I said a few divrei zikaron for the former chief rabbi of England, Rabbi Yonasan Sacks, and I got this comment from a listener in England.
I'm from England. I heard what you said about Rabbi Yonasan Sacks. Just want to tell you that none of the rabbanim, Hamish rabbanim, held much of him.
I'd like to respond. You know, I agree that the rabbanim in England are, you know, they're kodesh, they have their kehillos kodesh, but I'd like you to consider the following thing. Shevet Levi, Rambam calls Kodesh, Kodesh Kadashim, right? Yisachar, Shevet Yisachar, was the Sanhedrin, Rashi says, Chamor Noises Sfarim. You had Shevet God. God Gidid Yugudenu. He was the warrior. He stood on the Sapor. Like the Gemara says in Erevin on Daf Memhei, but if Mechaber and Shin Chav Tes, we need warriors by the Sapor, Yimchal and Shabbos, Yershus of Avu Anachrim. So here's my Shaila. Imagine that you were Rebbe Kivega, or you were pick any Gadol, and you come to Shul, and somebody from Shevet God pulls up in their tank, carrying a bazooka, whatever other weapons, you know, warriors carry, and they were davening with the minion. How would this Rebbe Kivega look at this warrior from God? Would he say, who needs this, you know, the Neshek and the... What would he say? Look, we need to have people by the Sapor too. Yira smucha l'Sapor. In other words, everybody has their job. Now, when you think of Jonathan Sacks, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, he wasn't in yeshiva. He wasn't talking to yeshiva bachram. He wasn't trying to end for Rabbi Kivega Shailov Litzrer. Who was he speaking to for the most part? The 11 million Jews who don't know who Avraham Avinu is, majority of them. How do I know? I was once looking for somebody to work in the office, you know, who could work on Chalamayit, who could work later times. We have an office in Lakewood. It's all from people. So I hired somebody, mamish, with a goyish in mamish, like a McLarican, like, you know, with the ganze Allah. One day, one of my admins comes in and she says, you know, this guy is, the maiden name is a Jewish name. So I called the person in and I said, do you know anything about Judaism? A little bit. Did you ever hear of Abraham? No. Did you ever hear of Isaac? No. Who did you hear of? I heard of Moses. Why? Because I watched a movie, The Ten Commandments. I saw Moses. I mean, never heard of Avraham Yitzchak and Yankiv. So there's 11 million people like that. You know, where I'm same at from Klal Yisrael, sadly. Who did he deal with? You know, he dealt with when the biggest atheist in the world, the one who wrote The God's Illusion, Richard Dawkins, you know, wanted to have a debate with a Jew. He took Rabbi Sacks. I actually watched the debate. And he, I thought he beat him very handily. He beat Dawkins. And this was viewed hundreds of thousands of times.
When Yehuda pleads for the life of Binyamin, he says, Eich elel avi v'hanar einenu iti. So the Talmidei HaBaal Shem Taich, Eich elel avi, how will I go up to my father in heaven, Avinu Shebashamayim, v'hanar einenu iti, all my brothers, my Jewish brothers, are not with me. In other words, as vis-a-vis Cain, who said, Hashomer achi anechi, Yosef said, Eich elel avi. And this consumed Rabbi Zaks. And do you know that for generations, going back to the beginning of time, both in the Litvish world, the Hasidish world, the Sephardish world, one of the biggest accolades you could say about somebody, if you look at the Hesped of the Noyde Behud, the Ramchal, Wordeyasim Rabim Heshev Meyavain, he was consumed by the love of Eich El Elavi.
So we need the warriors. Who else? This is a man who never went to yeshiva, went to Oxford, got a doctorate in philosophy, and dedicated the rest of his life towards speaking on BBC, writing 20-some-odd books. I heard from a Rav who's into Kirov. It's a different world, the Kirov world. A rabbi, and he said the number one book used for Kirov with, you know, intelligent kids is a book from Rabbi Sachs called The Letter in the Scroll. Here's a rabbi, Rabbi Wild from Manhattan, whose life is about Kirov. Listen to what he says.
Having been involved in Kirov for the last 25 years, my focus has been on the 80% of American Jews who have little or no connection to Yiddishkeit. And for that population, and not only here in the United States, but in Europe and throughout the world, there has been no contemporary Torah figure that has been more influential and more inspiring to that chevra, to that huge population, than Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. He did not pretend to be a Rosh Yeshiva teaching Gemara and Rishonim to Yeshiva Bachrim, but he was an eloquent and articulate spokesperson for Torah values, for Torah ideas, to really the Hamon Am, to the huge number of secular and unaffiliated Jews. I can't tell you how many times I personally gave out his famous book, A Letter in the Scroll, how many times I've recommended his many other books, which he authored, that speak to the vast number of Jews for whom Torah is simply not a part of their lives. And it bothered him that so many of our Jewish brothers and sisters were so disconnected. And he devoted his life to showing them how profound, how relevant, and how beautiful Torah, mitzvot, and really a life of Yiddishkeit can really be.
So what do I say to my holy English listener? I say, the Navi says two things. You know, does it say, Im yir rabach doyim l'malach Hashem tzvaka is toiru yivakshim yipiyu? That's one. But there's something else. What does it say? It also says, "B'shalom u'b'mishar halach, v'rabim heshiv meyavain." There's a different Rebbe of the Rabim Heshiv Meyavain. So if you asked me, should he come to one of the big yeshivas and say Yeshir and Yevamis or in Baba Kama and say Pshat and Rajba, the answer is no. But when we need Rabim Heshiv Meyavain, sadly, we have almost, I can't think of anybody on his quality of speaking, writing, representing Klal Yisrael to the world, you know, in front of Malachim, Adarber Lefnei Malachim V'loy Eivosh, he was uniquely talented. So I respect what you're saying, and I also think that we're both right. Now here's another call we got this week. This is from a Rav in South Africa. Listen to what he has to say.
I was listening to your podcast, and at the beginning, that story of Reb Moshe with regards to Bittul Kohuna. And I must say that story, you know, one never knows the exact circumstances that were presented to Reb Moshe. But from that story, it's being used now, Bushofi, to be Mevatel so much Kohuna that it's being used in the wrong circumstances, and it's being used to disastrous effects. Here in South Africa, we have Kohanim who, as of yet, might not be Shomer Torah Mitzvos, and their father may not have been, but somewhere along the line, obviously, they were. But they are exceptionally proud of their Kohuna, and they have a Cheskas Kohuna. They are very particular when they come to a Beis HaChaim, not to stand in a place where, you know, next to a kever. They're very particular if they're in shul during duchening, then they're not comfortable to duchen, that they walk out for duchening. So they're very proud of their kohuna tremendously. And yet, whenever some of them, now what's happening is, when somebody wants to marry someone that they're not supposed to, bittul kohuna, the story of Reb Moshe and Mevatel Kohen. And by the way, we've spoken to Gedolei HaPosekim of Zmanenu, and they've acknowledged that, you know, South Africa, and I'm sure other places as well, where you have this kind of a Cheskas Kohuna, is different. And yet the story is going out as a blanket, get-out-of-jail-free card for anybody who's somewhere in the heritage. They were known from people, and now they're Kohanim, they've got a problem. You can immediately just get out of it. And I think it's really bringing about, it obviously wasn't Reb Moshe's intent, but it's bringing about a churban, in my view, of the value and the status of Kohuna.
And I agree to this, Rav, too, but we used to always put on a disclaimer and say, Rabbi Sai, this program is to open up, give you the Mara Mekaymas, make you intelligent, you know what to ask, you ask your local Rav, and it gives you Mara Mekaymas, Deyas, Svaris. But it's not the Paskin. I mean, imagine if we had a surgeon on, and afterwards one of the listeners would say, excuse me, Rezala, could you grab the butter knife? I just heard the surgeon, I want to operate on the front cortex, the frontal lobe. You'd say, I'm a shugana, right? I mean, to paskin shilas of kaihanim, who's mutta, for this you don't need stamarov, you need a godly, you need a mumcha b'psak. So I'm adding that disclaimer based on our chashiva rav from South Africa. I want to say avart, you know, I like to say avart on the parsha. You know, hine malache elokim oilim v'yardim bay. Yaakov is sleeping. And he sees Malach Elokim Oilem v'Yardim Bay, and the Gemara in Chelik says Oilem u'mestaklem b'diokna. They went upstairs and they stared intently at the Dmos Diokna'i. V'Yardim u'mestaklem, and they peered intently and looked. And Tosfos says it was the same Malachim. Tosfos on Daf Tzadik Gimel, I think, in that neighborhood. So Shamati from Chacham Echad, he said, what was Oilem u'mestaklem v'Yardim u'mestaklem, the same Malachim? Every person has a d'mos l'mayla, you and I. What does that mean? We have an aspirational, the shayrish of our neshama, who we were supposed to be, who we really are, l'mayla. There's another one of us, l'mata. And you know what? By Yaakov Avinu, the d'mos l'mayla, who he was on high and who he was l'mata, they were identical. They were totally congruent. There was no inconsistency from who he believed he was, who he wanted to be, and who he actually was. And that's really very unusual. And I want to have a machshava. I think it's a hiliga machshava. The next week's parasha, you see, Esav, who hated Yaakov so much, Yagveni Zepamayim, my brother, the thief, the scoundrel, twice he took my b'chayra, v'gam b'rchasi, he took my bracha too, is coming with arba me'es ish. And Rishonim say he wasn't, Yaakov said, Achapra panu b'mincha, I'll buy him off. He wasn't bought off. He was angry. And what does Yaakov tell him? In lovan garti, and Rashi says, v'tariag mitzvah shamarti, he comes down and he embraces, he kisses, he cries as brothers. And the question is, what did he see or hear that made him change his mind? So Rashi has a pshat, but I want to go with a different pshat. I want to suggest something. I want to say, you know, he stole the brachas. And Esav, I mean, did Esav really want the b'chayra and the brachas? Esav was, Oivag, Rashi says, Avayda Zorah, Gilei Raish, Vichazdam, and brachas at the Gedarft. I mean, a big part of it is, he says, Yakveni Zepamayim. Twice he beat me. He outwitted me. Nobody likes to be the fool. What does he see the Yaakov coming towards him? He's away from home now for 34 years. 34 years, and he isn't away in Eretz Yisrael. He goes to Lavan Harami, the biggest thief. He's in the flesh pot, the biggest Avarian, Shegetz, right? And what does he say? In Lavan Garti, Vitaryag Mitzvah Shamarti. He sees Yaakov with his bird and payas and Erlicha kids and the wives, and he could see the Shechina, and he said, you know what? He really meant it seriously when he took the Bechaira. It wasn't to get me. This really spoke to him. This goes to the essence of who he is. He's Erlach. He's living up to what his beliefs are, to his morals. And you know, Goyim respect Jews who respect their own morality. Not the Jews who are always trying to machnach. When they see somebody who's ernst, who lives a moral life according to what he believes. He's toiche kabarei. He's consistent. It engenders respect. You know, they say over, there was a fellow by the name of Otto Frank. He was a Jew. He became a meshumid because many stories. He wanted to join the waspy world. They say he wanted to get into the West Hampton country club. And when he shmad, they let him in. So once he was speaking, it's a joke. I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but it brings across the message. And he was speaking and he was addressing them, you know, with great, very happy. He finally got in. And the president kicks him under the table and he says, Otto, stop addressing the members as my fellow goyim. Right, so what's the message? He sees somebody who's sincere. You know, we have Yidden that when they go to work, they change. The Dmus Lamaila and the Dmus Lamata totally become incongruent. That they're inconsistent, they're dissonant. And you know what? Both for themselves, it's very destructive to themselves. What do we know? How did the Baal Shem Teich, the Magid, this is a vert we have from the Magid, really from a Mokim Rachik. Right, there was a Jewish, a friar Jew, right, Maimon. He was by the Magid two times for Shabbos, and in his memoirs, he writes this part. He says, the Magid teached, Vayehi kiminagein haminagein, v'tishrel of Ruach Hashem. Everybody has a story that they talk. You know, everybody you meet, everybody's got a narrative. But often the narrative doesn't represent what you really believe, who you really were. It's sort of a game face. So he said, the Magid teached, when the song you speak, you sing, when your narrative matches who the menagin really is, then it's Vatishral of Ruach Hashem. Yaakov was kimenagin hamenagin. When he went to work, Zeliesrim Shana Beveisecha, he stayed, Taryag Mitzvah Shamarti. We have a professor, he says, every year, Rachmana Litzvan, professor in college in Columbia, she says, a boy comes into her class, every course, comes in with a yarmulke and leaves without a yarmulke. You know, he wants to fit in. He wants to. People should like him. You know what? They will admire you if you are consistent with the Tzuras Adam Lamaila, even Esav HaRasha. Maisa Avasim Labanim respected, gained a new respect for Yaakov at that moment. I want to share with you another thought. One more thought. You know, all these parshas are the stories of Klal Yisrael. And you know, we learn, we'll go back to Rabbi Akiva, Litzra, we learn all the dinim of Tzara from one word, a whole mesechta, half a mesechta on a few words. And we have parshas and parshas with stories, 68 psukim, about how Eliezer finds Rivka. And Rashi remarks it and he says, Yafa si chasan shal avda yavis, yaisa meterasin shal banim, that just the stories of the Avdei Yavis, the Sichas, the mild conversations. How much straw did he give to the camels? Did Lavan give to the camels? I mean, is that really important? Yafa Si Chasan. And I ask you why. Why is Yafa Si Chasan? And I want to suggest the Torah is telling us something really important. Si Chasan means the culture. It's G'dayla Shimusha. How did they behave? What's our culture? And you know, after Me'ev Esrim Shana, your child is going to much more remember the Shabbos table, the Sipurei Tzadikim, rather than another blot in Baba Kama. I realize somebody may criticize me for this, but that's what I believe. That's the Yafa Si Chasan. Rav Shach said, he sadly once remarked, and he said it in public, or I wouldn't repeat it. Rav Shach once remarked, he said he didn't, it seems, have nachas from his children. And he said, my next-door neighbor used to sing Zmiris. He says, Chassidei Shefela always sang Zmiris by the Shabbos table, had good kids. He says, and I was learning Tzais and Asivis by the Shabbos table, and he was right. That's the Yafa Si Chasan. Yafa Si Chasan means, yes, it's true, you could drink Chol of Stam, Ramesha Road, and we've spoken about this here, but you know, when you open up the refrigerator and everything's shining with Jewish labels, there's a Yafa Si Chasan, there's something about our culture. What are the stories we're telling? Amar Reb Yitzchak, Koyach Maisav Higid La'amai Losseis Lem Nachlas Gayim. The first Rashi, the stories Maisav Higid La'amai, this is how we conquer the world, is the stories, the Shabbos table, the culture, the heroes we have. But let me finish this week. Let's leave with a story. We're talking about Yafa Si Chasan, a story that I've heard that I think is a beautiful. This week is the Yard Site. It's coming week of the Rebbe Baruchel of Mezhebizh, the grandson of the Holy Baal Shem Tov. And here's a story I heard as a child that I thought's worth repeating. You know, Reb Levi Yitzchak of Baditshava, Reb Levi Yitzchak ben Sarasasha, he always wanted to spend Shabbos by the grandson of the Baal Shem. But Reb Baruch Hu was very different. He was very proper. He lived like in very royalty with laws, nobility, with a waiter, etc. And the Baditshava was totally different. When he used to daven, he would scream, he would forget who he was, he would jump on the table and jump on the chairs and shake, and it was a sight to watch. So he asked Reb Baruch Hu, can I come for Shabbos? And Reb Baruch Hu said to him, he said, listen, holy Baditshava Rav, I run a very organized shul. You're going to turn my whole shul. You're going to make me crazy. I can't. So the Baditshava said, listen, I've wanted to come for so long. I'm telling you, I'm going to be on my best behavior. So we came for Shabbos. And, you know, usually by Boi V'Shalom, he would start running around the shul, the Baditshava, and jumping and opening up windows to let the Shabbos in and the scream. And he just sat by his seat. Best of manners. By V'shamru b'nei Yisrael, Shabbos, he used to scream so loud, people's eardrum. He said it quietly, like everybody in the shul. By Yichulu Eidus, he would, again, everything comes to the meal. Kiddush, the way he used to say Kiddush, the Kiddush of the Baditshava could take an hour. Here, he did it quietly, like the Rebbe Baruch Hu, nothing. Best behavior. Baruch Hu sitting there thinking, wow, see? Then they brought the fish around. Baruch Hu was very proper. He had a little waiter. He used to brought the fish. He came to the Baditshava and he said to him, "The Rebbe hat lieb zisa fish or the gezalzene fish? Do you like sweet fish or the salty fish? Does the Rebbe love sweet?" He asked the Baditshava. And they say they could see the Baditshava holding on to the table. And he was shaking. And finally, he just couldn't stand anymore. And he jumped up and he threw his arms up. And he gave a scream, "Levi Yitzchak hat lieb fish. Does Levi Yitzchak love fish? Levi Yitzchak hat no lieb de bashefa. Levi Yitzchak only loves God." And when he threw his hands out, the platter of fish flew out of the waiter's hands. And the fish flew all over the room. And the yoich, the sauce, flew up to the ceiling. And the chassidim watched in horror as from the ceiling, the fish is dripping onto the talus. He used to eat with his talus, Rebbe Baruch Hu, of the Rebbe, the Holy Rebbe Baruch Hu of Beishabash. Fish and sauce all over. And everybody, and the Baditshiv is screaming, "Ich hab no lieb de bashefa." And Rebbe Baruch Hu picked up his hands, his chassidim, calm down. Don't do anything. This is a person who only loves God. And they say that the Rebbe Baruch Hu, he never let that talus be washed. He kept that talus. He said, "This talus is covered with the tears and the love of somebody who only loved the Rabbi Nishal Elam." And it was handed down from generation to generation. The last person to have that talus was the Munkacharav, who died before the war, I believe in like 36 or 37. And he asked to be buried in the talus. He said, "I see a great darkness coming to the world, and I don't know where this talus will reside, so bury me." And they buried him in the talus. So these are our heroes, and these are our Yafasi Chassan, our Maisi Avais. And you know what? If we remember Yafasi Chassan, our children will remember it. Hopefully we'll remember that. Let's go to our riddles of the week. Okay, two riddles. Last week we had Vayetar Yitzchak Onechesh. He was in spal for his wife, Akara. Here's the question. Sarah, Rivka, and Rachel were all Akarais. Vayetar Yitzchak Onechesh. He was mispal for his wife. We don't find any of the other Avos being mispal for their wives except for Yitzchak. Why? Now here is riddle number two. You know, Chazal really commend Rachel for giving over the simanim to Leah. In fact, the darshan, kol baram anishma, why was nehi koylech mi bechi? Why bischus Chazal say that she gave over the... Now I have a question for you. Imagine you're married. Your husband saved up for 7 years, right? 7 hard, brutal hard years of work, money. I can't sure what he wants to do with the money. He wants to make, he wants to make an addition to your house. 7 years. And you have a sister who needs the shidduch, and the boy says he's only going to do it if he has money. So you go into your husband's bank account, you empty out the bank account, and you give the money, nadin, to this guy, this future brother-in-law, so he'll marry your sister. Would that be commendable, or are you a ganif?
To me, it's borrowed. You're a ganif. If they took you to Beis Din, you'd have to, you know, Isha, I don't know who you go. Or the other way around. Anybody takes their spouses, their money to... Yaakov worked for 7 years to marry Rachel. She took the 7 years and she fooled him. She gave Leah and he had to work another 7 years. And what are those 7 years? Kerach, Baloilov, Atidad, Shnasi, Me'enai. He worked in cold and in frost at night and in day. And, I ask you, how lahalacha, the obvious were Mekayim the Torah, they had a Choshe Mishpah too, and they had an integral Choshe Mishpah. How could she possibly do this lahalacha? Those are our two riddles of the week. As always, if you'd like to send in a comment, 732-806-8700, and for comments, it's 2. Or you can email us info@headlinesbook.com. We do put up the comments and the letters online where readers or listeners can access them unless you request otherwise. Let's go to our wonderful guests.
Joining us from Toronto is Rav Mordechai Kanner. He's the Rav of Kol Yaakov. He's a Talmud of Gateshead, Ponovich, Lakewood. Learned in the Kol for many years by Rav Shlomo Miller. He's a Musmach of the Rashi Gebahagra Moshe Feinstein. He was an expert on Ribbis. He wrote a sefer on Ribbis called A Matter of Interest on Ribbis. It's an honor to have you with us, Rabbi Kanner. So Rabbi Kanner, let me ask you a few questions, okay? Let's say you're a tenant. You live in a building in wherever, in Lakewood or wherever it may be. I was actually rented in Lakewood. And on your lease, it says, if you pay after the 5th of the month, there's a $100 late fee. Is there a ribbis problem with that or not?
So the thing is like that. Paying a penalty is actually does not qualify as ribbis. However, we find in Shulchan Aruch that paying a penalty on a paying late on a loan is also under the term of haroma ribbis. It has the appearance of ribbis. Nevertheless, Shulchan Aruch mevuah that a transaction of purchase and sale or service provided, a late penalty, is not considered haroma ribbis. It's mutter by mekech emimke or schiris. Provided that it's only a one-time penalty, and it's not increasing with time. So therefore, if a one-time penalty is permitted, in case a person wants to charge for the next month, then you could charge a penalty again for the next month, and you could make the arrangement in the beginning that any money that's coming in is going to pay back the debt of the previous month. So therefore, if the time is the time, you could always charge penalty on the new months that you paid late, and therefore it's going to be incentive for the person to pay up on time.
Right. So a one-time penalty, a late fee of $100 or $200 for paying past the 5th would be mutter, but if they said you have to pay an additional $100 for every 10 days you're late, that would be us, sir.
Right. Unless you make a hat iska.
Unless you make it. Right. Now, let me ask you another question. Somebody lends you money. Your uncle lends you money. Well, better yet, your father lends you money. And now your uncle lends you money. So because of that, you send him like a really nice shalach banis. Or alternatively, you lend the gabbai in the shul money. And because of that, the next week you get shishi. Is this a problem or not?
Something that you have done in the past, you should continue doing. And that's really, one has to differentiate between what kind of favors one is doing. If it's a favor that is done in public, called a faresia, then the aloch is more stringent with that. Because it's always a maras ayin, people will not know why this has been giving, and people might be interpreted as giving because of the loan. So therefore the halacha is like that. To do it because of the loan is definitely prohibited. But if the kavon is not to do it because of the loan, and if you've done it in the past, you have a certain relationship with the person, then you'd like to continue sending him shlachmon. In case, let's say somebody's a kohen that bidden a ben and he lent him money, or given ali and shul, that is something that is faresia. Everybody sees, and people might talking, even though not everybody knows about the loan, but the fact that the favor has been rendered in public, that could cause people to talk and inquire and finding out, like, why is he doing that, and people are going to associate that with the loan. So therefore, it's not permitted unless the relationship is such that everybody understands. Nobody could wonder why the person... Why the person bought him this aliyah, or why he chose him as a coin for Pidna Ben, for instance, is his relative, or is his rov, etc., then it would be permitted. But it has to be obvious why he's doing that favor.
In other words, if it's something that he would have done in the normal course of life before the loan, you can continue after the loan. But if it's something that was incentivized by the loan, then it would be problematic. So, Rabbi Kanner, let me follow up. What would you advise somebody, curious situation? He lent the gabbai and the shul money, and suddenly the guy gives him shishi. He never got shishi before. Does he not go up to the aliyah? Like, what would you do if that happened to you?
Yeah, that's a problem. That's a problem. There is a school of thought that could be that he got the kibbutz already. The fact is that he called him up already. It's too late. So the kibbutz has been given already. So now it's not to be a latoira. Once he be called up, he can't go a latoira. So the kibbutz, the avera has happened already. The fact that a latoira could be that that's not be also to a latoira.
Now, what do you, Rabbi Kanner? What would you do? I don't know if you ever had children who weren't in Eretz Yisrael, but you learned in Eretz Yisrael. You were in Panevish. Yeah. So a friend of yours in Panevish, you need a loan. So he lends you, he's from Canada, so he lends you, $50 Canadian, and then when you pay him back, you want him to pay him back the same amount that $50 Canadian is worth, but in shkalim. So you now want to give him, let's say it would be 3-1, so you would give him 150 shkalim. Is there any problem with that?
No, if the loan, the loan is being Canadian dollars in Canada, so you obligate the paying back that $50 Canadian, and if you make up to pay this in a different currency, that as long as you pay back using the exchange rate at the time of repayment, that's no problem.
So would it ever be a problem doing this? How could somebody be nechshol doing this?
If you don't use the exchange at the time of repayment.
I understand. If you would use the old
right. You can't use what the shkolim was worth at the time that you paid. So if you can't pay more than the currency that has been lent to.
Now, what about somebody says he runs a gamach, and he says, "Look, we lend money out, but you know I work here. We have electric costs, we have office costs, etc. So on to every gamach loan, we charge a service fee." Would there be any problem with that with Ribbis?
No. To charge for expenses is permitted. The question arises that if you're going to charge everyone the same amount because you're paying for the expenses, there's no reason why one should be paying more than someone else. Let's say you take a loan for $10,000 and the other person takes a loan for $500. There's not much more... work involved for the person who's taking the small loan and the bigger loan. So there we're running a particular problem. How could one collect more from somebody who takes a larger loan versus somebody who takes a smaller loan? Nevertheless, the operators can permit that as well, especially nowadays. It's a common thing that you charge a 13% percentage-wise, that the service fee is a percentage-wise. And therefore, the operators can permit that even if the person who's taking the larger loan would pay more than the one takes a smaller loan, although the overhead costs, the fee should. It's important to point out that the people who pay that should know that this is towards the overhead expense, the cost. Can't just say that anybody takes a loan has to pay a percentage. People have to know that this percentage is going to its expenses, because otherwise it could be marshal people, the Indian from Lifna Evil, the person thinking that he's paying ribbis, the person thinking that maybe a small amount he'll have to pay ribbis, and not knowing that you marshal the person. So therefore it should be clear that the person who's paying the that fee is paying toward the expenses and not not a ribbis charge.
Okay. What happens? You have a neighbor, your wife goes in, she borrows a bottle of olive oil. And when she comes to repay, she sends another bottle of olive oil, the same size, 16 ounces. And she's not sure, maybe the new bottle she's sending back is cold pressed and it's more expensive than the bottle that she got. And there could be a difference in the price. She doesn't remember what type of bottle she sent. She sends one over. If it's indeed more expensive, is that a problem of ribbis? And what do you do if you don't know?
Yes. So the second question you're asking is, if a person doesn't know how much he bought, let's say this is relevant not only for a bottle of oil, if a person doesn't remember whether he borrowed $100 or $150, so he is definitely allowed to pay back to make sure that he pays what he owes. That's not paying between ribbis, but you're paying this back to make sure that you're paying back what you owe. So there's no problem with ribbis and debt. Even if you know exactly what you borrowed, as in the case of the bottle of oil, so the poskim are makel something which is derech shchene bekar. Usually when neighbors or close friends, usually when you borrow, you're not makpit exactly on what you took. So that is not viewed as paying as interest, as paying more and repaying because of a favor. But that's the derech shchene, not to be makpit. So that's not viewed as ribbis.
Okay, now on the first case, when you said you're not sure how much you borrowed and you pay back extra, why wouldn't that be a shaila ribbis?
Because the reason why you're paying that is because to make sure that you're paying back what you owe. If a person is not certain how much he pays, even though you could say hametzavir all of a raya, but if you don't know, so apichosh mishpat, the person can be moitzi more money from you. But nevertheless, if you want to make sure that you're paying back what you owe, so you're not paying betoyres ribbis. The issa of ribbis, you saw it of is ribbis, is agenata. Paying agenata means to paying because I used your money. But over here, I'm paying it betoyres the principal.
So intent is very important. Kavan is very important.
Yes.
Rabbi, I want to talk about iska, but before we go to iska, could you think of one or two cases where people are commonly over on... It could be ribbis, avak ribbis, where they're not aware of it. Like, you know, sort of like common things where people, hey, I didn't realize that that's ribbis. Can you give us an example or two?
That's if a person borrows foreign currency, for instance, a person in America, in that soul, a person at the soul borrows U.S. dollars, and the U.S. dollars goes up in value, so you can't pay back the same amount that the amount of the foreign currency that you borrowed.
A yeshiva bacha in Panevej or in the mayor borrows $100 from his friend.
Right.
And the dollar goes up, and it was 350 at the time, and the dollar goes up to 4 shkalim, right? So he borrows 100. If he pays him back $100 a month later, he's over ribbis, because in effect, in the local currency, he's paying it back 400 shkalim, not 350 shkalim. I would bet you, Rabbi Kana, that 99.9% of yeshiva bacharim or Americans are not aware of this problem. But
right.
could you explain to us why? Because since, in effect, you are now getting in the local currency more shkalim back,
right,
we don't care that you pay dollars and dollars,
right,
because, in effect, now, does it matter the fact that in Eretz Yisrael the dollar is almost considered like an equal currency to the shekel, or that really,
it's
secondary?
Yeah, the person still deals with that like payers. The foreign currency is considered like payers, even though
they should hang this up in the mirror yeshiva, this halacha, because I'm telling you, yeah.
But again, if a person borrows money on foreign currencies and he possesses some of the foreign currency, that falls under the category of yeshloi, sobe sobe yeshloi is permitted. Meaning that if you lend money or pay us a certain quantity, and the loiva possessed some of the merchandise that he borrowed, so then he's allowed to pay back even though the price went up.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
There is actually another heter for some poskim want to be makel that Ravosner, Heisen, Chuvi, wants to tell Hokel, but Roy poskim holds that if he's not Yeshloi, you're not allowed to pay back more. If the price increases, you're not allowed to pay back the same amount of foreign currency in case the price increased.
Right, right. And it's particularly surprising because, you know, the Rif says that when it's Tzarech Laritza L'Sholchanei, it doesn't have a Din Matbeya. I would just have assumed that in Eretz Yisrael it has a Din Matbeya, but what you're saying is very, very important.
Then. Take out, it's just called payers. Yeah. All foreign currencies are treated like payers.
So, Rabbi, can you tell us a little bit? I know you're an expert in Heta Iska. Explain to us briefly how Heta Iska works, and then I want you to talk about, are there problems doing hard money loans with Heta Iska?
So the way the principle of Heta Iska works, that the money is not advanced as a loan, but rather as an investment. That is the side of Heta Iska. Heta Iska works that the money is given towards an investment, and the interest that's being paid is not considered as interest on a loan, but the money is considered as you're getting profits on the money that you invested. Now, the basic difference between an investment and a loan is a loan, you guarantee that you're going to get your money back regardless. In the case of an iska, meaning an investment, so it depends what happened to the investment. An investment turns sour, then you lose your money. Now, why would a person lend money with a head iska if he could lose the money? So therefore, the iska is based on requiring the borrower to prove that he lost the money or that he didn't earn profits on the money. So we make it quite difficult for the lawyer to prove that, meaning that you could prove the proof that you lost the money has to be proven with two kosher edim that have to know what happened with the money that you were given towards. And you have to make a shvur, you have to prove with a shvur that you didn't earn the money. And in lieu of making the shvur or bringing the edim, we could arrange the kapchila that if I'll give you a certain amount of money, then you're going to relieve me from the obligations of proving with Adam or with Shvur what exactly happened with the money. So in other words, the money that you're getting in the poskim, it's called the Mehis Pashas. The Mehis Pashas means that the money is giving not as interest on a loan, and even if you happen to have lost the money, but you would have to prove what exactly happened, so we make up that if you pay me a certain amount that we make up originally, then you'd be relieved from any further proof that you'd have to provide to tell them what happened with the money exactly and how much you should be entitled or not entitled to. So that's the story of Heta Iska. So Heta Iska, again, is not a way how you get around an Issa Dereis of his ribis. But the principle of Heta Iska is based on the fact that it's an investment and there is a risk factor involved. This is the major difference between a Heta Iska and a loan. Because a loan, there's no risk involved. And in a Heta Iska, there's always a risk factor. But most of the time, people would not take advantage of the right to be able to swear, because people don't want to stay shying away from making shvuas, and sometimes very difficult to prove exactly what happened with the money. So maybe when you're paying the money, you're basically releasing yourself from your obligation to provide proof what exactly transpired with the money is given to. So this is the basic principle of Heter Iske. And therefore, there's no Issa Ribis involved when you make that Iske. And like Kapila, people should understand what Heter Iske is all about, because if they don't know what they're doing, then and they think they're doing it just as regular loan, that they become obligated to pay the money. And based on the Heter Iske, in case he lost the money, Be'etzim, he's supposed to pay back the money. But the reason why he's paying the interest is, as we said before, it's like Meis Pashrus is in order to relieve yourself from having to prove exactly what happened with the money.
Now, what about a hard money loan? I know that you've spoken about how hard money loans could be more problematic.
Hard money loans, you probably mean when the interest rate is
very high. Yes.
Yeah. It's hard to say there should be also. It's hard to say that it's hard money loans because you could make all kind of investments. When I lend you money, you could invest in money in any type of investments you want to. And sometimes you invest in second or third mortgages, which you get a lot of higher interest. So Mamela
would be the same. You believe it would be the same thing, hard money loans, the same.
Yes.
Now, what about common thing? Somebody lends their credit card to a friend. Their friend is in a store, and they say, wow, I see there's something here to buy. I wish I had my credit card on me. He says, no problem. Take my credit card, and you'll pay me back. So he borrows his friend's credit card, and he buys the thing. And he doesn't pay him back for 60 days. And because of that, the guy incurs a charge of interest for 2 months.
Right.
So is he allowed to pay his friend back the amount of the money he put initially on the card? He charged, let's say, $500. And then the 2 months interest, if it's running, let's say, at 2% a month or something like that, would be another $20. Is he allowed to do that or not?
Yeah, the answer is you cannot. This is an interesting halacha, because any expenses that involve any expenses that is being generated because of the loan, a loiver is allowed to pay. Let's say you need to prepare legal documents for the loan, then you could request the loiver to pay for that. If there's wiring charges and et cetera, that could all be charged back to the loiver. But nevertheless, the expenses of the malva, let's say the malva borrows money from a bank, he has a credit line of credit, and you borrow money from your account, from your line of credit, in order to provide the loan to someone else, that's not considered an expense that you're allowed to charge back to the loiver. So the same thing happens over here. If somebody uses your credit card, so basically what happens that the malva is paying to get the money. This is an expense he cannot charge back to the loiver.
Right. In other words, we see it in effect as two separate transactions. When the credit card is used, the bank is lending your friend the money, and
right.
He's responsible. They're not coming after you, the person who used the card.
Right.
And then he's being charged interest, and he is then turning around and charging you to pay back his interest, which
right.
is a separate transaction. So therefore, in effect, he's charging you interest, and that would be Asa.
Exactly.
Well, Rabbi Kana, thank you very much. It's an honor having such a great Talmud Chacham, an expert on Ribbis, with us. Thank you for sharing your time.
Yes. Kol tov.
Agotcha. Bye-bye. Joining us from Brooklyn, New York, is Rav Baruch Miller. He's the Rav of Kol Beis Mordechai in Flatbush. And he's the Rosh Koyel and Beis Yosef Nevardik, the great Nevardik Yeshiva. Welcome, Rav Baruch.
Thank you so much for having me, Rav David. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I know you've given shiurim on Ribbis, so we're going to ask you a number of shilas that are sort of common that people may not be aware of, but that they could be over on. So let's say you're sending your kid to camp, and they say, you know what, if you pay us in full by I don't know. I haven't had a camp in a while. You pay us in full by April 30th, we give you a 5% discount. So it should be $1,000, LaMushel. You're going to pay $950, or it's a 10% discount. Make it easy. You'll pay $900 if you pay us 90 days in advance. You're basically getting a discount for giving them the money in advance. Now, for these 90 days before you got to camp, you're not buying anything. So, in effect, it's a loan, could be argued, for the 90 days. Is that a shaila of Rebbe's? And that could happen both in camp, it could happen in tuition, it could happen in many different cases. Advance prepayment with a discount, Rebbe's or not?
Yeah, it's a great shaila, one of my favorite Rebbe's shailas. It's one of those that, it's kind of like those 3D pictures you look at where you don't see it at first. People will stare at it, but eventually then it pops out of you. And a lot of Rebbe shailas are like that. You ask the standard person about this case, and they wouldn't even see what the shaila is. But then when you explain it to them, it can clearly be a question of Rebbe's, as you're explaining. This is very often done. Camps will offer what they call an early bird discount. You sign up, and you give some money early and by a certain deadline, and they will offer you a discount for that. The halacha that's paskened in Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Kuf Pine Gimel, is that any time there are two price points for something, something is worth double or shelvy a base, and you give a discount because someone is doing what's called hakdomas mois, is giving the money early, that is a problem. And the psak of the Shulchan Aruch is any time you are mefarish, you clearly stipulate two different price points, one if you're paid up early, and one if you pay at a later point in time, that is a problem of what we call nechsi karibis. It looks like ribis. So based on that psak and Shulchan Aruch, this should definitely be a potential issue. There are a couple possible criteria that are discussed amongst the Paiskim for this, and everyone should ask their local Orthodox rabbi when the Shaila comes L'maisa. Nothing I will say here is meant to be used Halacha L'maisa, but there are a couple as far as that people want to use to be matter. Number one, in many instances, the account does not necessarily have to be paid in full immediately. A deposit can be left, and as long as a deposit is left, you give a few $100s. I don't know if that was a different question you were going to ask, but let's just discuss that case. They tell you pay $300 as a deposit today. That they say we can view that money as just a nominal amount in order to hold your spot. It's not actually giving them the money, the entire amount today. That heter is not great to use. I don't, personally, not a huge fan of it. Number one, in many instances, the camps do require, as you just mentioned, they do require the account to be paid in full by a certain date prior to camp starting. They may say by February 31st, you have to pay $300 as a deposit, but by June 1st, you have to have your account paid in full. So that would be hakdamas mois, that would be lending the money early. And the camps really need this money. They're using this cash, they're not putting it in escrow, and it's important that they have this cash up front in order to be able to pay vendors and leave their own deposits. And therefore, it really is a hakdamas mois, where you are lending them money today to provide a service for later. Another possible heter that's discussed, I believe Rabbi Yashiv wanted to use this heter in certain cases, is something that we call sfiras poilim, which is a halacha that's brought in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Kuf Ayin Vav. If you are hiring workers and they're providing a service for you, even if the service may not begin mamish today, but even though the service may not begin today, but the schiras begins today, that has a lumdus of not being a halva. The schiras is considered a kinyan today, and therefore there's no loan of money. I'm giving you money today to create that schiras pilot. Some want to argue that in these cases, in a camp, let's say, that's part of what is going on. The lumdus of what is happening when you pay that stuff is you're not simply paying for a service later on. There is also a shibud created, a schiras poilim that is created today when you give that money. That may be a heter. It's hard to believe that that's exactly what's happening. I think most people look at it clearly when they're paying for camp, they're paying for a service later on. Certainly an example is of things like a magazine subscription, Mishpacha magazine, Ami magazine, whatever it is. It's hard to imagine that we could look at it as a schiras poilim, we are hiring them today. Really, the best heter, the bottom line, is the heter from Rav Moshe, same is true from Rav Moshe in Yeridaya, Siman Samach Gimel, where Rav Moshe says that any corporation, it's okay to lend them money bribis, not borrow from them bribis, that's a different question, but you can lend them money bribis, and his logic is far being that a corporation, because they have a limited liability, There is no Shibud Haguf created. You don't have any person that is personally Meshuvah that has a mitzvah in the Torah to pay you. It's just their assets are Meshuvah to you. When you lend them that money for camp, their assets are Meshuvah. But because there's no personal liability, it says it's okay to lend them money, Brivis. To use that for most camps you're going to find nowadays, magazine companies, in most instances, schools are incorporated. They are limited liability corporations, and they would have the Heter of Ramesha. It's not, people, Paiskin, will use this Ramesha in some cases, will not use it in some cases. Here it's a little easier because you're dealing with that worst, only Mexic Ribis. It's not Ribis Deraisa. It just looks like Ribis, therefore it's easier to use the Heter of Ramesha. It's interesting that the Marshak, years earlier, before Ramesha, wrote this Heter as well about corporations. His Lumbus is a little different than Ramesha. He only was willing to say that it's not Ribis Ketusa, that Ribis Deraisa because of the limited liability, but he still seemed to hold it was Ribis Derabonon. But either way, Ramesha says that it should be Mutter Lagamri, and if you're willing to rely on that, that would be a Heter in most of these cases, assuming the camp or company you're dealing with is a limited liability corporation.
Well, I would just add on, Rebaruch, to what you were saying, is that even though there are those who don't hold the Ramesha's Heter, but given that you also have, you know, Rebel Yashiv's Heter and the Tyrus Ribis, and if it's a deposit, you have the Marsham's Heter, so you could certainly combine two or three of the Heterim, and on Isidra Bunan, you certainly could be Simach on a Smach Lahater, given that there are so many different opinions.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. I would think so, but everyone should leave it to their own Rebbonim.
Okay. So let me ask you another question. You call somebody to clean your oven or a plumber. Everybody needs a plumber, right?
Yeah.
The plumber sends you a bill, and it says on the bill, as many bills say, it says if you pay within 30 days, the price is $100. I don't know if you can get a plumber anymore for $100. Let's say $200.
Probably not.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if you pay in if you pay after 30 days, then we charge you an 18% late fee, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you pay this bill? Or alternatively, if you actually have a service company, right, you provide things, are you allowed to charge this extra fee?
That's another excellent question. This is discussed already in Rishonim. I believe the Rosh was the first to discuss this. There's a concept called Derech Knas, where it's not Rivis, it's not seen as interest on the loan, but as a penalty, it's a late fee, and that may be different than Rivis. The Rashba does say that in Iker Hadin it should be different. He believes in Lumdus it should be different, but as Maxi Karibis, he says it should be a problem. And this is the Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Kufay and Zayin Tishyadav. However, the Rivash discusses this, and the Rivash says that even though the Rashba said it's Maxi Karibis, but that's only when it's money for money, when there's a loan. So someone lends you $100 and says, you have to pay me $100 back, but you don't pay me by this date, then you owe me $120, then the Rashba, he's uncomfortable with it, and he says, it's Mexi Caribbean. But if it's a service, like in the example you're discussing, and for that service you're paying money, so it's what we call Derech Mekach Lemkar, it's not a straight loan, in such a case, the Rivash says that even the Rashba would agree that it's not Mexi Caribbean, and it is okay. This Rivash is brought by the Raman Shulchan Aruch. It's brought by the Shulchan Aruch himself at a later point in Siman Kufay and Zion, and is what's passed in Halacha L'maaseh. So in theory, that should be okay. There are a few important stipulations that you need to keep in mind when you're doing it. Number one, I noticed in your question that you mentioned that it was an 18% bump. I don't know, I'm not sure if that's okay. When the Paiskim say the Petr Rivash, they say you give a specific amount. $20. And that specific amount could be regardless of how much, if it was a $250 service or a $200 service, the bump, the fee for late paying late is X amount of dollars. Then it's okay because we don't see that as being related to the loan itself. It's a knas added on. I'm not sure if you make it a percentage of what was owed. That may be an issue that may again get you into a problem with Mr. Curtis. I'm not 100% clear on that point. The places that I've seen who bring down this Heter all say it as adding a specific amount of money. So that's one thing I would keep in mind in this. A couple of other things that are important is that it can't extend the amount of time you have to pay it up. If the plumber was to tell you, you have to owe me this by November 1st, if you don't pay me by November 1st, you owe me $30 more. And then you can then it's extended to December 1st, the deadline. That's very uncommon,
I think.
That's very uncommon.
I would like to add on. I would like to add on that the Rav Shulchan Aruch in Hilchos Ribbis Simin Memches opines the same way that you're saying as well. She's saying a one-time knas you would be allowed to. So if let's say you have a paper copier, you fix copier machines. You say pay me by this date, otherwise we tack on $100 late fee. As long as it's a one-time event, you'd be allowed to do that. Now,
I believe so. Yes.
You send a friend to the store, and you say, could you get me some donuts or some challah? And he comes back, and you say, how much was it? He says, it was $9.45. And you say, look, here's a $10. Well, I don't have any change. Just keep it. Now, in effect, when he laid out the money for you, it was a loan on your behalf. He was lending you the money.
Right.
And now that you're paying him back an extra, the $10, because you're not bothering with the change, in effect, you're giving him ribbis, right? You don't mean to do it for ribbis, but in effect, it is ribbis. You're paying him back more than the money he laid out on your behalf. Is that ribbis or not?
This gets into a category that we might call ribbis mokheres. It's not obviously not a ribbis deraisa because you didn't ask him initially to pay any more money, but it could be a potential problem of after the fact giving him some extra money. The halacha that's passed in the Shulchan Aruch is that ribbis mokheres is only usher when the intent is to pay him extra for the loan. When my kavana is something else entirely, to give him a present, or in this case, it's just because I want to pay him up and he doesn't have change, it's a convenience factor, then there shouldn't be a problem of ribbis. There's an interesting machlokes from the Shulchan Aruch Harav and the Machane Ephraim. What is the case? What is the halacha when it's b'shas pirun? At the time you're actually paying. Meaning, it's one thing to say when I'm not paying for another 10 days and I give you a little extra money, as long as I have no intention for ribbis, it's okay. What if at the time I'm paying up my loan, I give you a little extra money? The Machane Ephraim says the same halacha applies, and it has to do with the intent of the person. The Shulchan Aruch Harav, though, is of the opinion that regardless of the person's intent, at the time of payment, you cannot give extra money no matter what. The Minchas Yitzchak writes about this exact question you're discussing. He says it's okay. And he says the reason being, again, because the intent is, it's even for the benefit of the loiver. He wants to pay up today. He doesn't want to have to bother going to get changed. So when it's for his benefit to pay up today, he doesn't want to go and get changed. And he says that it should be mutter. He's not unequivocal about the heter. He says it should be okay. He wants to suggest possibly that the malve should give the extra money to tzedakah. But he does seem to want to rely on this heter. I'm not sure. The sukkah, is this totally in the machlokes Shulchan Aruch Harav that I just mentioned and Machane Ephraim or not? Meaning the Shulchan Aruch Harav is saying that at the time of payment, no matter what the intention is, it's usher, maybe that would affect this case as well. He would not agree with the Mitzvah Sitzetzer. It doesn't matter that at the time of the payment, it's for the loiver's benefit. It's usher at the time of payment to pay a little bit extra no matter what. Could be, one could argue that the Mitzvah Sitzetzer is even better because it's for the benefit of the loiver to pay. He wants to get this loan paid up. He doesn't have change. It's a pain. Therefore, it could be even the Mitzvah Sitzetzer would apply, even according to the Shulchan Aruch Harav. But either way, because Yitzchok is my turn, says it's okay to keep the drink.
Yeah, I mean, would this be similar to the case of like borrowing something from a neighbor and he gives you back a different size, et cetera, where you just say, you know, people just don't care about these things. So it's so inconsequential that we don't consider that. Would that be a similar case to this?
It certainly would be similar. And the heterim used in both cases could overlap. The heter in that case is based on the Ramah, the Lashon of the Ramah, that sounds like you can pay back the loaf of bread regardless.
Kikar b'kikar.
It's a little bit heter. Kikar b'kikar, right.
Nobody cares.
Onion for an onion, you can pay back. No one cares. It could be the Mitzvot Yitzchok as being marked in this case, even if it is a little, even if it's 75 cents. But people do care. Maybe it's a few dollars even. Maybe he owed you $7 and he gave you $7. So it would be a little more than what the Ramah is willing to be marked, that slightly larger onion or challah. It could be even then the Mitzvah Sitzetzer is being matir, but it's definitely a valid point that the heter of the Ramah, by kikar v'kikar, could overlap in these cases.
Yeah, nobody really cares. It's petty, it's indifference. Now, let me ask you a question. Yeah. Let me ask you. Let's say you say kikar v'kikar, or I lend you, your wife comes and she borrows from me, I don't know, a pot. And she says, and you say, okay, I'll return you another, you bought a new pot, and she gives it to you. and your wife then a week later buys her a pot, but you were toivel the pot, so now you've added on like some incremental value. Or you borrow a bottle of olive oil, and there's so many different qualities, and hers was like some pedestrian olive oil, and you gave back first quality olive oil. Now, I would think that's problematic, but here's my question. Let's say the other person doesn't even know. They gave you a bottle of olive oil that cost $5. You bought one back, it's $15, and you give it to the other person. But to them, they're not a ganze gourmet chef, and they're going to use this $15 olive oil, whatever it is, whatever the number may be, three times the cost to light the Shabbos candles or to fry an egg. Does the other person have to recognize it, or once they don't recognize it, we say, look, if they're not aware they're getting it, there's no ribbis here?
I would think that it is a problem. I would think that if it's something that's recognizable in the market as being a higher quality thing, from what I remember, I think Tyson even say if you borrow extra large eggs and give back jumbo eggs, that's the problem. You're talking about small difference.
But the other person
may not even notice.
Yeah, but I'm saying, if they don't notice, then you're saying, and yet it's still a problem.
You have to be careful. I don't know that SARS like that would work here just because the person doesn't notice. It's not a problem of rivets. Its value is more, and it shouldn't. I would think that it doesn't matter, but I don't know.
Okay, let me ask you another question.
I would think Butler died, so it's a golden head. Yeah.
Let's say somebody lends you money, and you tell them, you know, that was really fantastic. You have no idea. You pay them back. They lent you $1,000. You were stuck in an airport someplace, and you say, you mamish saved my life. Like, you absolutely have no idea of the favor you did me. I was stuck. I was in Rome for some reason. My credit card was denied. It was, like, just an amazing thank you. I can't thank you enough. Here's your $1,000 back. Is that problematic?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's obviously appropriate for this weekend as we discuss what the Yiddish Hashgacha on giving thanks is and what it's supposed to mean. But this is it's a shiloh that Paiskim have discussed. The halacha is that you're not allowed to, if someone lends you money, you're not allowed to say shalom. Shalom aleichem, you're not allowed to say to the person if you wouldn't have done it otherwise whenever he lends you money. There's an interesting question in the Paiskim that comes down to Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe, where they discuss two cases. Number one, this case, let's say where you say thank you. Rav Moshe holds, and it seems to have arrived from Shulchan Aruch Harav like him, that saying thank you has an intrinsic value to it. It's just like saying shalom, and saying thank you to the person is meant to mean something. It's meant to mean I owe you, and therefore, even just saying the word thank you, Rav Moshe seems to hold, would be an issue. Rav Shlomo Zalman has a tshuva where he says, and then Shlomo where he says that it's okay. It's a little unclear what his lumdus is, why he's saying it's okay. I'll tell you how I understand his lumdus, but I see from many of the contemporary person that they may understand it a little differently. To me, I understand that Shlomo Zalman is saying that there is no intrinsic value in the thank you. It's the meaning is infused by the heart behind it, by the person that puts it in, but the words themselves have no intrinsic value. Even though Rivas Devarim may be usher, that's only something like a bracha. Bracha has value. You say shalom aleichem, shalom is a bracha. So that has intrinsic value. But just saying the words thank you is not something that by itself, in essence, has any meaning. It's the heart behind it that gives it its meaning. And therefore, the hanoah, not like Shlomo Zalman says, not every hanoah is usher. It's not that I can't, if he feels warm about it, I made him feel great. That's not the issur of Rivas Devarim. That would, if that's how you understand Shlomo Zalman, that would be matir saying thank you, even in a very effusive manner, the way you just described, where you really go out of your way to thank the person and express how much it really meant to you. The Paiskim, the way they bring down the Shlomo Zalman, when they bring it down, the Shlomo Zalman and Rabbi Yashiv, they say a simple thank you is okay. What they mean to say, I believe their understanding of Shlomo Zalman to mean that just thank you is the way we talk. It's understood. Everyone has to do that. It doesn't mean anything. And therefore, a simple thank you is okay. If that's the understanding, then the way you're saying it with someone, if someone really goes above and beyond to thank the person and is very effusive in their acknowledgement, that would be a problem, even according to Shlomo Zalman.
Yeah, and look, again, the Shulchan Aruch Harav and Hilchos Ribbis of Tess seconds what you're saying, that an effusive thank you, any type of that would
right.
certainly be problematic. I think a lot of people are not aware of that.
No, absolutely not.
Now, let me ask you...
I'll just
go ahead.
Tell you on the side. I thought that there was a Shiloh that brought the Shalom Gelber brings up in the Sefer Mesivas Shalom. What can you say? I would say thank you, but the Torah says I'm not allowed to.
Yes.
He wants to bring a riot in this week's parsha. He says, Lavan was told by Hashem to be careful. Shalom will be very careful.
Shalom midaber and Yaakov mitoy vadra.
What does he say, Lavan? He says, I would say that thing. I have really kindness on you. He says, I really should have a tie on you, but you're a Kodesh Baruch Hu. He said I shouldn't say anything to you. So he wants to say that that's a dimming to this. He's telling him, I would say something, but Hashem said I'm not. So you can say to the person he wants to ask him that I would say thank you, but Hashem told me I'm not allowed to.
Okay, that's great. Let me ask you a question. Somebody lent you money a few years ago, and you meet him by a simcha a few years later, and you say, you paid him back years ago, and you say, you have no idea the money you lent me at that time really was just, it saved my life. So now you're doing it a year or two later, or 3 years later. Does this din of Ribbis Dvarim expire with time?
The Dr. Tshuva says that it's only before the payment is made. Once the payment is made, you're allowed to say thank you. He even says, interestingly, that the time of the payment, as long as you wait, a few seconds, and now it's done, then you can express that thank you. I saw that there's a shaila brought down. Is the Dr. Tshuva's heter apply even if you say explicitly, I'd really like to thank you for that halva that meant really a lot to me? Or is he just talking about a generic thank you, where you're not in the farish that it was that I'm saying thank you for the halvah? Someone a question that maybe if you're mafarish to thank you for the halvah, for example, you make an acknowledgement in a book that you wrote, that I'd like to thank this person for lending me that money and that allowed me to publish this book, even if the loan has already been paid up, that might be an issue. But the pashas of the Dr. Tshuva with the idea is mashma that once the money is paid up, there's no issue at all and you can say thank you regardless.
So, Rabbi, tell us, in your experience, as somebody who's spoken on Ribbis, learned Ribbis, give us an example of a case or two where people may be over on Ribbis and they just don't even know it.
I'll tell you a fascinating case that came to me recently. A lawyer who's a scholar in my shul, he called me. He said two women want him to draw up a contract for each other. One of them is lending the other one $15,000, I think was the example. And the other woman is going to give her some jewelry, some valuable jewelry as collateral. And she wants to allow her to use the jewelry in interim while she has it. She wants the malva, the lender, to be able to use it, nice stuff. And she'll wear the chasnas, whatever it is, and she's going to use it until the halva is paid up. And he was asked to draw up a contract for these two women that stipulates this, and they asked me if that's a problem with Ribbis. That would be a clear issue of Ribbis. Really say any way out of that. That would be a classic example of what we call mashkanta b'loin nechaisa. You're giving a collateral and you're not deducting anything from the loan for the use of that mashkan. That could be a real problem. Pashtus b'psak halach l'maisa that's ribbis deraisa.
Give us another. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I thought of a good etza for this person to get out of this would be to structure this a little differently. Structure it not as a halva, not as a loan, but structure it as a sale. You can say that the woman is not lending her, but the woman is actually selling her the jewelry for $15,000. And there is a buyback clause that says that at the end of the year she can buy back the jewelry for the price of $15,000. That would be in the first halacha that I'm incorrect, that would be a problem of ribbis, that you're not allowed to stipulate that the person has to sell it back to you. However, the reason why I thought that this would be okay is because many Paiskim, Gedolei Paiskim, Chazdas, Chachmas Adam, they understand the halacha to only be when it's not clearly stipulated as a buyback. When it's stipulated and when it's stipulated in a way that can be understood as bitul mekach, as retroactively the entire sale is null and void, that's when the problem is created. What happens is you're selling her the jewelry, and at the end of the year when you pay her back the $15,000, there's a void on the sale. It starts over again. And now you borrow the money for the year, and she was using the jewelry. But if you clearly stipulate it as a buyback, that should be okay. However, I thought this would be a good Hector. I spoke to Chaim Cohen about it. He said he did not agree with this Hector. He said this is a real elbow. This is a rhombus ribus. And even though technically in lumbus it may be correct, he said you should stay away from this. And the only way to allow such a case would be to knock off some of the buyback price, lower it from $15,000 to, let's say, $14,500, something like that, that would compensate for the year of use.
Uh-huh. Rav Baruch, it was an honor having you on with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate it.
Kol tov, agatzer. Bye-bye. Joining us from Beit Shemesh is Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky. He's a Talmud and a Musmach of the Kesmak Rav. He spent the last 40 years researching the Messiah on animals, behemoths, birds, and he is the world expert on the Messiah of all out everything we eat. Welcome, Rabbi Ari.
Hi, thank you.
So, Rabbi Ari, today is Thanksgiving. This week is Thanksgiving. And most Jews eat turkey. I know Rabbi Yankiv Kamenetsky, Zichron Levracha, didn't eat. I know the Marshal didn't eat, etc. But for the rest of us who do eat turkey, what do we do with the Ramah in Yeredeya Pei Beis, right? Where he says, I'll read the Lashon. It's, Ein lechel shum oif, ela b'mesayreis shekiblu boi shehutayr. And since we only eat an oif, we don't trust the simanim, we only eat an oif with a mesayra, the turkey was discovered in 1492 or something like that by Columbus, the Indians ate turkey. It was brought to Europe, which means it wasn't in the times of Chazal. We didn't have it, not in the Torah. We don't have it, not in the Mishnah, not in the Gemara, not in the Rishonim. It's only really in the earlier Achronim that we first, the first, how can we eat a bird without Masaira? Certainly us Ashkenazim that go B'derech HaRamah.
Okay, well, a few things. First of all, you're right, there are a few people who don't eat it. It's not only Rav Yaakov Kanevsky, Rav David Lifshitz didn't eat turkey. Descendants of the Shloh supposedly don't eat turkey. There's a Darkei Tshuva that says that in the early 1900s, when you married into the, what he says, the famous Frankel family, you had to write in the Ksuva that you weren't going to eat turkey. But you're also correct that the overwhelming majority of Jews eat turkey. I have not been able to find any kosher agency that doesn't give hashkacha on turkey. So the first point that I want to make is you mentioned that specifically according to the Ramah, and that's what many people quote. They quote the Ramah, as you said, in Pei Bet Gimel. But if you go back to Pei Bet Bet, the question's on the Svardim as well. The Shulchan Aruch, the Machaber says, the Alpha Appreciation of Gimel Simonim Elu, we don't eat any bird with the three signs because we're afraid that it's a doris. Meaning that the Mechaber, like the Ramah, says we only eat birds with a Mesorah. So your question really is on all American Jews, Ashkenazim and Sephardim. How come we eat turkey? And what I think is amazing is that even though turkey came to Europe in the 1500s and Jews clearly started eating it in the 1500s and 1600s, there was no shaila that I could find, is turkey kosher? Rather, only much later, in the 1800s and 1900s, there were shailas about why is turkey kosher? And the poskim give a wide range of answers. Some of them, I would have to say, are a little embarrassing.
Well, the Marshal, I believe the Marshal held it was in kosher, and the Marshal lived in the 16th century.
I don't remember the Marshal. That could be. I'm not going to comment either way. It could be, but he might have stated that simply giving his opinion. I couldn't find any shailas that came to any of the poskim, is turkey kosher? But you have lots of people asking in the 1900s, the 1800s, why is turkey kosher? And you get a wide range of answers. Some of them very problematic. People, even Sichas Chulin brings one of them that I find the most problematic. He says that some people say we eat turkey because it's from the New World, and we know, he says, that some of the 10 lost tribes were the Indians that were in the New World, and they were eating turkey, and we're being soymich on their Masorah. I find a very troubling answer.
So the Indians did a lot of other things that not exactly allowed.
The Sichas Chulin mentions this. He meant there are other poskim who said this is in the Meir, I think it's there. Somebody from the early 1800s. He says we know that turkey came from India. There was a Jewish community in India, and we're relying on those people. Also, not so good. Then there are answers that are a little bit more realistic. There are some people say, why do we eat turkey? Because turkey is really just a big, funny-looking chicken. And so turkey comes through the door on the tails of the chicken masara. The problem with that is that turkeys are really not so closely related to chickens. And if you're going to rely on that, you've really opened the Pandora's box where we can let in lots and lots of other birds. Others say that why, we just read in the Mechaber, why don't we eat birds without a masara? Because we have to be concerned that it's a doris. Well, what they say is, turkeys, we have no concern that it's a doris. We've been raising turkeys for years by the millions, and we now know everything about turkeys, and we know that it's not a predator. And therefore, we don't need to have a masara on it. So that's what others say, and that would also open a sort of Pandora's box for today. I think the best answer, if you want what I think, is really the reason we eat turkey today is what the Netziv says. The Netziv says that we only eat birds with a masara, and the Netziv says, I have a masara on turkey. A masara means that my grandparents, my Rebbe, told me that it's kosher, and they told me that it's kosher. He said, it's not your job to go back 500 years and to say, but where could their masara have come from? Judaism is mimetic. We rely on my grandparents to tell me what an esrog is. You rely on your teacher to tell you what the aleph bet is. You rely on your teacher to tell you what he has a masara on. And that's what the Netziv says. We eat turkey because we have a masara. Now, you could undo it. If you could prove to me that a particular bird is a doris, you could prohibit it. But the burden of proof, the Netziv says, is on you to prohibit it rather than me to explain where the masara came from.
But here's the problem with that, okay? The reason why we need a Messiah is because we're not sure today what the exact simanim are. Like, example, what's a doris is hotly disputed in the Rishonim, right? Rashi, other Rishonim, Ramban and Rashi
go
at each other.
Right, at least four opinions, right. The Tosfos goes on the Rashi there.
Right. So there's certainly, you know, so we don't know what it is. So therefore, Messiah means that we know that this was accepted back in the times when they knew what the simanim were, right? Now, since the simanim were lost before 1492, right?
Mm-hmm. Rashi says
we lost the simanim. So this new Messiah is post the date when we lost the simanim. So it's a worthless Messiah. I don't understand the
no. So what
he's
saying is, it's not a worthless Messiah. He's saying, you're right, you could prohibit it if you could show me that it's a doris. And pick any definition. If this bird that I'm eating today fulfills any definition of doris, then I'm willing to answer it.
I understand what you mean, but what's the purpose? If the purpose of the Messiah was because we're getting it from the people who knew what the simanim were, and we know that this Messiah is clearly past this period when we did not, it started when we did not know what the simanim are, so it's built on quicksand, this Messiah.
Maybe, or maybe they weren't possibly like the Rama, or maybe they knew, I don't know, 400 years ago they were Gedolim. And for some reason, the turkey got in. That's what he's saying. You don't have to ask how it got in. That's not your job. There's a Messiah that exists today. And your job isn't to try to guess how it got in. Maybe it got in, like those who say that we don't necessarily possibly like the Mechaber and the Rama on this. Maybe it got in because hybridization. If you could crossbreed it with a kosher species, then it's kosher. We don't know how it got in. But that's what the Netziv is saying. You don't have to try to figure that out. If you have, from your Baba, a Masora, you have a Masora. I don't know. I like that answer. But you can go with one of the others if you want. You can go relying on the Indians if you want. There are other suggestions that people give that are clearly erroneous. Not in the Poskim, but other people, when you talk, they say, well, obviously the turkey's kosher. It's New World. And in the Torah, remember, we didn't have simanim in the Torah or need for Masora. The Torah gives us a list of the non-kosher birds.
24.
And everything else, right, 24 non-kosher birds, everything else is kosher. So people say, well, obviously the turkey wasn't in that list because Moshe Rabbeinu knew those 24. Now, of course, that's a fallacious answer because those 24 aren't species by the modern definition of species. They're categories of birds. And clearly the American eagle is not kosher. And presumably, if you had brought the American eagle to Moshe, he would have said, yes, it falls into this category or that category. So just the fact that it's New World doesn't prove that it wasn't in the list of the 24.
Absent in its Netziv, we have no way around the Ramah and the Beis Yosef?
No, other than a sieve, we have that observation. We have that we've observed it for decades, for hundreds of years, and we know that it doesn't answer any of the criteria of Doris, and therefore we no longer have that chashash, and then we could rely on the other three simonim.
So could you walk us through the machlekes, whether you need three simonim, four simonim, just to educate our Olam a little bit. We're not so learned in these things, okay? Give us a short summary on some of the halachas in these issues. Okay.
The Mishnah gives us four simonim. The Mishnah tells us that any bird that's a doyres is not kosher, and any bird that has three simonim, an etzpiatera, an extra toe, a zefek, it has a crop, and korkavon and niklaf, it's pipik, it's gizzard, it's peelable, is kosher. And then the Avraham Machlokes Rishonim, how to use those signs. So many Rishonim say that if it has the three positive signs, meaning Etzbi Yisrael, Zefek, and Kukov and Niklof, that proves
explain,
that it's not
explain,
a Doris.
Could you explain to our Olam what the signs are? What is Doris, what is Zefek, what is Etzba, etc.?
Okay, Doris, we translate usually as predator, but as you mentioned, there's a big Machlokes Rishonim. Rashi, for example, says that it just means that it holds the food down with its foot and then eats it. And Tosu says that can't be, because that's what chickens do also. So Rabbi Notam says that it means it eats its prey alive. Rambam says...
Which is problematic, because chickens eat insects live.
Correct. So that's also, it doesn't really solve his problem. The Rambam gives a different... The Rambam says that doyris is that it catches the food while flying, mid-flight. It catches its prey. The Ramban says it kills its prey with its nails, with its claws. So you have a variety of definitions of what these simonim mean. Then you have the etzpiatera, an extra toe. So even that, which would seem pretty simple, is the machlokes the Ran and Rashi. Rashi says the etzpiatera, the extra toe, means on the back of the foot there's a toe that's higher up than the others. The Ran says no, it means in the front you have three toes, and the middle one is extra long. It doesn't mean an extra in terms of the number, it means an extra in the length. The other two, there isn't really a machloikas about. The zefek is just the first stage in the digestive system. It's the crop. That's where the chicken stores its seed. When it eats it, it keeps it there, and then it hides from predators, and it digests the food. And the korkavon, the pipik, the gizzard, is the last stage in the digestive system, and that's where all the garbage is before it comes out. It's a thick piece of muscle, and inside is a membrane that peels out, sort of like a garbage bag coming out of a garbage pail. It just takes all the garbage out, and you're left with a clean piece of meat. Almost like a sign from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that was supposed to be fleshik. He designed it so it nicely takes out all the garbage. So those are the signs. And the Rambam, for example, was very into the korkavon. He thought if it had a korkavon niklaf, that was the key sign. He quotes the tradition from the Gaonim that was the key sign. So even, as you point out, how to use these signs is problematic. Do you need all four, and all four are independent? Do you need only the three positive, and that proves that it's not a doyris? Is the korkavon sign enough without the others? So each of them is a question of how you use it.
So now go through a turkey. What does the turkey have?
So the turkey has all of them. The turkey has a korkavon niklaf, it has a crop, it has a peelable gizzard, it has an extra toe, and we don't think it's a doyris. But if you want, I could just give you an interesting story that is a New World bird whose halachic trajectory was very, very different than the turkey, if you have a moment.
Sure.
Okay, so the turkey, as we saw, New World bird, widely accepted around the world by Jews. By the way, before we get to the other bird, I just point out that in America, you're only eating turkey this week. But Israel actually has the highest per capita consumption of turkey. In Israel, we eat more turkey per person than in the U.S. by about 50%.
Wow. I also want to point out, for anybody who's listening, even though we asked you not to paskin halacha l'maaseh from this program, the Mishnah Brura paskins that Agavorcha in Hilchos, at least in Hilchos Tefillah, when he's talking about Lagabe, it's like Ayin Tess over there, that neighborhood. He talks about Lagabe Reyach Ra. He says like a Haidu, like an Indic, which the guy in the bottom says it's a turkey.
Right.
Is Kasha. He says it Agavurcha. So he didn't have
any issue
with
it. He's bringing it there. It's very interesting you point that out. It's a very problematic Mishnah Brura. He's commenting on On soya of a ben odom, you can't daven mulet. So of an animal, you can, except if there's a reach ra, you can't, with three exceptions. And one of them is the tsoya of a tarnagol odom. That's from a Yerushalmi, says tarnagol odom. And the Mishnah, the brewer identifies the tarnagol odom as a turkey.
Right.
And he says, therefore, you shouldn't raise it because you can't daven mulet tsoya, implying, though, that it's kosher. But he's identifying, it means, a bird that's mentioned in the Yerushalmi as a turkey.
Interesting. That is very interesting.
But nonetheless, yeah. You're correct. He is saying that he views it as kosher. Irrespective of that historical problem, he knew what a turkey was, and he was postulating that it's kosher.
Yeah.
So I just want to say there's another bird which had a very different story. There's a duck called the Muscovy duck. It's different than all the old world birds. It looks a little different, quacks a little different, and that's found in southern U.S., Central America, and South America. And that, for some reason, didn't make it to Europe as fast as the turkey. And the first real Rav to confront the Muscovy duck was Rav Dr. Bernard Illouay in New Orleans during the Civil War. And he saw this bird. He said, I don't have a Masaira. Why are you guys shechting it? And they said to him, well, the canter in Charleston, the duck, the Muscovy duck. And so he thought, can be Europe, Tetzei Torah. He wrote a letter to Rav Hirsch and Rav Adler, the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, and they both agreed with him that the Muscovy duck should be usher. And from then, the Muscovy duck in the United States has been treated as usher. A few decades later, some rabbis in South America, in Argentina, came across the Muscovy duck. They understood kimitzion teitzei Torah, and they understood that for a rov to paskin about birds, he has to see the birds.
Makes sense.
So they sent a male and a female Muscovy duck by boat from Argentina to Yerushalayim, to Rav Shmuel Salant, by a nace. One of them actually survived the boat trip. It came to Rav Shmuel Salant, who after trying to convince his guest of Chaim Bolin to paskin, and he wouldn't, he paskined, he took the bird, he examined it, gave it to his shochet, and said, prepare this for Pesach. And from then, the Muscovy duck has been permitted in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank talked about it. He said, just like you've been saying about Turkey, he said, I don't understand why it was permitted, but this was already the 1950s. For 50 years, they were eating in Yerushalayim. He said, at this point, we can't turn it around. And up until the early 2000s, it was being shechted as kosher here in Israel under the Rabbanut. So the Muscovy duck, another example of a new world bird, in the United States, accepted as not kosher, and in Israel, it's accepted as kosher.
And is it not dairus? Like, does it have all the same simonim?
So it seems to not be dairus. Interesting. Yes, with the simonim. Most ducks and geese actually don't have a zephyr. We eat them because we have a mesoira on them, but they actually don't have a zephyr, most of them.
Interesting. So it's a riot that you don't need all four simonim. It's a riot to the...
Correct. So it's but you ask it, actually there was a huge controversy about 10 years ago when at the end of December, it seems that in America there's always a duck shortage because the non-Jews have a holiday where they eat duck. And some Muscovy were sent to one of their Mishlacht houses, and they accidentally shechted them and sold them. And so there's a little bit of a controversy about 10 years ago surrounding the Muscovy duck.
So it's interesting. So in Eretz Yisrael, you eat it, and in America, you don't eat it.
Yep. That's what the...
And I believe the Paiskim say that if somebody goes from a place where they have a Messiah to a place that doesn't have a Messiah, he's allowed to continue with the Messiah. So in Eretz Yisrael, who comes to America...
If he's visiting, if you go back to, you had the Shulchan Aruch in front of you before.
Right.
He discusses that, right.
Right. So if a guy has an interesting riddle you could ask, how could two people eating by the same table, two from the people, eating a piece of meat, for one of them it's treif and for one of them it's kasha?
Right.
The answer is an Eretz Yisrael who comes to America is eating a Muscovy duck. Over here, he could eat it and the Jew can't eat and the from and the here can't eat it. Interesting, no?
Yeah, I guess that would be. I don't know. Like you said, I don't paskin, that's for sure. But there are others who want to say, no, Muscovy was a mistake what happened in America, and you should even serve it there. Like Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank said, he didn't understand what happened here. Maybe there are those who want to answer it here also. So I guess it still could be an open question.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add to this topic that you think our Olam would be interested in?
I think people might find it interesting that if we're relying only on Masorah, only on traditions, that would imply that in a particular generation, if you have X number of birds that you treat as kosher, the next generation is obviously going to have either X or fewer. We can't create traditions. And we've really been losing them very rapidly in the last 50 years, because it used to be all shechita was local, whether in Eastern Europe, in North Africa, in Iraq, and every local shechit knew the local birds and had mesorahs of which were kosher, which not. Today, those communities are all gone, and all shechita is centralized. So we've really been losing the traditions. There's a book called the Zivchei Kohen, which lists 30 birds that Italian shechit in the 1800s had a tradition on them.
Including the peacock, he says is kosher.
Yeah, yeah, he has the peacock, and he's not the only one. There's a lot of evidence the peacock used to be viewed as kosher. So what I would like to ask anybody listening, if you have any grandparent or great-grandparent who could tell you about birds that they knew about, whether it's from North Africa or in Europe or wherever it might be, that they had a tradition on, we're losing them very rapidly. Today we're going to probably name only 7 or 8 birds that we have traditions on. And as I mentioned, not even 200 years ago in Italy, he had 30 birds tradition on.
Now, the Zivchei Kohen, if I remember, has pictures, doesn't he?
He has pictures. He does.
Are his pictures good enough to establish Mesorah L'chaira? They should be, no?
So I've tried asking that to Rav Schechter and other poskim of kashrus organizations, and they all insist on a living Mesorah.
Wow.
I've even tried making it more. I said, let's say I take a video of a guy, and he shows me the bird from all angles, and he gives me the name in 12 languages, and then nobody eats it for 100 years. Would that video be good enough? And they all seem to want a living Mesorah.
Interesting. I wonder what the Mekorah is for Halacha for that. Interesting. Well, Rabbi Ari, thank you. It's been fascinating, and thank you for sharing with us your decades of work.
Okay, thank you for bringing this to people's attention.
Cult. Thank you. All the best. Bye-bye.